Ernst Hogendoor, former senior advisor to U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, says there is plenty of blame to go around, that things could have been done differently, that civilians could have been included more in the negotiations of the Juba Framework Agreement, which were supposed to lead to a civilian-led government. Hogendoor says U.S. diplomats were all quite worried about conflict breaking out between the two military factions, adding that, quote, rightly or wrongly, that worry was always in the front of our minds when negotiating with the actors in Sudan.
We could have included more civilian voices in these negotiations. Other things could have been done to kind of make the talks more inclusive. But fundamentally, one of the things that international diplomats struggled with was you had two very large armies.
Another messy outcome of the chaos in Sudan is how do Western nations get diplomatic presence restarted in the country? Former U.S. Ambassador to Sudan Tim Carney, who shuttered the U.S. embassy before in Khartoum, calls closing an embassy anywhere incredibly difficult.
The situation of today, with the evacuation of almost all the diplomats, as nearly as I can determine from Khartoum, is far different, where you have actual fighting in the city itself with everyone being frozen in place because it was deemed too dangerous to move.
Nureldeen Saadi, former charge d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum, who is a Sudanese, says the power in Sudan does not favor most civilians who have been pushing for democracy for years.
The balance of power is not in favor of the revolutionaries or the civilians, and that the military detained the guns and detained the wealth, while on our side we had the street, the power of the street. For how long is going the power of the street? Which one is going to outlast the other?
All the experts and former ambassadors and advisors taking part in the Atlantic Council event agreed the way forward is to first convince the two generals to stop fighting immediately and permanently. But how does that happen when both seem hell-bent on fighting to the end until one comes out on top? Thomas Warwick, a non-resident senior fellow at the Snowcroft Center for Strategy and Security at the Atlantic Council, says there is one way.
Attention now needs to focus on the sponsors of these two factions, the people who are providing both sides with weapons, with money, with support through business ventures and other kinds of means.
Egypt has been supporting General al-Burhan with warplanes and other military might, while the RSF is getting Russian-backed support from the Wagner mercenary group, which Warwick says has a history of atrocities not only in Syria and Ukraine, but has been fundamentally destabilizing throughout the Sahel, going as far west as Mali. Humanitarians say the international community can respond to the Sudan crisis by urging an immediate ceasefire, while also holding those who started this battle and previous atrocities accountable, something Nicole Wittershine, deputy director of the Washington Office of Human Rights Watch, says has yet to happen.
There's the ability of the international community to walk and chew gum at the same time. They're able to fund and stand up mechanisms to document human rights abuses, look immediately at justice processes and what's appropriate and what the Sudanese people might be asking for, because none of these explosions of violence over the last 20, 25 years have ever seen any true justice process.
Meanwhile, many residents in and around Khartoum say despite the 72-hour ceasefire due to end Thursday night, sporadic gunfire continues and they are too afraid to leave their homes as they come close to running out of food and water. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.